Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle! Today, we have another installment from the mini-series, The Human Mormon Mind. In the past, we have covered topics of priming, confirmation bias, groupthink, pluralistic ignorance, and religious cults. The topic for the podcast today is one that revolves around group dynamics and interpersonal relationships. This bias, called the illusion of asymmetric insight, describes our behavior, or our assumptions about our knowledge, rather, in the default disposition that we assume, in which we believe we can and do know the motivations and reasoning behind others' statements and actions, while others simply cannot know us. Perhaps this is best summarized in the phrase, "You don't know me, but I know you." Misha will explain it better once we get into the discussion, so let's jump into the discussion with Misha and Ben. Well, we are here again talking about the human Mormon mind. Today we are talking about a topic called the illusion of asymmetric insight, and we'll get to what that is in a minute. But I've got Ben Knoll, who's been on the podcast before, talking with Stephen Peck, and well, I think that was our very first psychology-oriented one, the one about priming with Brian Kissel when he was with us. So, Ben, say hello and tell us about yourself.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Knoll, as Brian said. I teach political science classes at a liberal arts college in central Kentucky. I'm married, I've got three little girls, and I'm one of the new perma-bloggers at Rational Faiths.
New to the fame of Rational Faiths.
Or the infamy, whichever.
The infamy. Depending on which group you ask, right?
Right, exactly.
And Misha McGriggs!
Hey there!
Misha is back being our resident psychology expert. Introduce yourself again, Misha, in case this is the first episode someone's jumping in on.
For sure. I'm Misha. I am working on my PhD, starting my fourth year in my PhD program in psychology, counseling psych at BYU, and I'm happy to be here.
Sweet. Well, I think we ought to just jump into what this topic is, and with that, let's listen to the mini-lecture Misha has prepared for us.
So basically, the illusion of asymmetric insight makes it seem as though you know everyone else far better than they know you, and not only that, but you know them better than they know themselves. This bias also extends to groups. As a whole, your group understands outsiders better than outsiders understand your group, and you understand their group better than its members know the group to which they belong. This idea is a little complex, but basically it's, I know you better than you know me, and I also know you better than you know you. And this is a cognitive bias, which means that it's not accurate, it's not true, it's based in ill logic. What researchers have found is that the way that we conceptualize ourselves is based on internal factors, and the way that we conceptualize others is based on external factors. So when I describe my personality, I'll describe myself based on things that are internal, like my integrity or my love for my family. Whereas if I were to describe someone else, I would base it on things that they show to the world. So I would say, well, I know Susie well because Susie likes to joke a lot, so she's funny. And she seems to get along with everyone and talk to everyone, so she's very outgoing. That may not be the way that Susie would describe herself, because we have what has been termed the Latin word persona, which is where personality comes from, but it's this idea that we have different ways of being in different situations. So like William Shakespeare said, you know, all the world's a stage and we're just players, right? So we're all walking through life and acting. And Carl Jung was particularly fond of the concept of the persona. And he said, that which in reality one is not, but which oneself as well as others thinks one is. So we put on these personas and we act in these different ways, in different settings with different people, which is normal, is normative, I would say. But we think that people, that we know people because of these personas that they put on. And we think they can't know us because we grant ourselves complexity and we grant others, we don't grant others the same. We only give them very rigid, allowance for rigid personality. So we categorize others in terms of black and white. We give ourselves a lot of flexibility and complexity with our personality. Does that idea make sense? Again, it's us wrongly believing that we know others better than they know us, and that we know them actually better than they know themselves. In the flagship study on this that was done at Harvard, what's been found is that they did several experiments, but one of the experiments that they did was talking about liberals and conservatives. And it was clear. Liberals thought that they knew conservatives better than conservatives knew them, and they also thought that they knew conservatives better than conservatives knew themselves, and vice versa. The same thing was true on the other end. So we want to be cautious as to check this cognitive bias. We're all susceptible to it, and I think that this is the way that we operate a lot, but I think it's important to be aware of it. When are we granting ourselves complexity but not allowing that for others? When are we making assumptions about people based on these personas, based on these external factors that are just not the full, the full spectrum of someone's personality? We want to allow others to have complexity and to operate within shades of gray, and we don't want to get caught up in projecting a single narrative onto somebody. So as this asymmetrical bias, as it occurs, watch for it and be cautious of it.
Okay, well, now that we've had a good definition of what this cognitive bias is, the illusion of asymmetric insight, let's talk about it a little bit. Have you noticed this tendency in yourself? Do you ever naturally think of others as complex individuals with complex thoughts behind their actions, or do you find yourself defaulting to simplifying the other?
Well, I think if you take it to like a, for myself, if I take it to like a meta level, I think I do. I think that I give people complexity, the same complexity that I want granted, you know, for myself, but I don't actually think that I do. I think that I walk through the world and kind of compartmentalize people and then, you know, operate in a way that I think that when I've got them figured out, based on X, Y, and Z stereotype usually, and because of these X, Y, and Z stereotype or past experience with this person, that I think I've got it figured out and can predict their behavior. And I don't like to think that I'm that. That I'm, you know, falling into that cognitive bias and being that simplistic with folks, but I think that I do quite often.
Yeah, I think it kind of makes sense to me that we think of others that way, because I get really tired trying to understand my own thoughts and opinions and beliefs and actions and stuff and trying to figure all that out just within my own head. But if I gave that much energy to everything else that everybody else does, I would never get through the day. So it makes sense that we do that, but it's sad that we don't recognize that we're simplifying in this way, which is a bummer. And one example of this, when I was in grad school, we had this graduate level thermodynamics class, and we had this exam, and it was awful, and we were all commiserating afterwards. And we were talking about this one problem that was really hard. And I remember saying, oh, you guys, it was this way, you know, and you had to think about it like this. And I tried to explain the way I was going about it, or I think I actually conceded that I got it wrong, and I thought of the right answer later, like we often do when we take exams, or the right way to approach it. And I tried explaining it, and they were like, no, that's not right. And in my head, I'm like, no, you guys, you're just not thinking right. If you would think right, you would clearly see that the way I'm explaining it is correct. And then when we got the exams back, I was wrong. didn't work out the way I was thinking. But I noticed as I'm thinking about times where this has popped up, that was one that came to mind where I had that awful thought that I think we often do is, if you would just think like me, then you would understand. Ben, do you have any other short little examples like that?
Okay, so yeah, the first thing that comes to mind that I could share is with my students in my political science classes, of course, because coming into the classes, we have students who have fairly well-defined preferences when they start out the class, and it's usually pretty clear when we start talking about different political ideologies or approaches to different political policies or such, that they tend to self-segregate pretty clearly. It's clear which students tend to be more liberal, which students tend to be more conservative. And of course, the ones who subscribe to a particular perspective talk about the diversity of views within their particular perspective of seeing things and give different nuances and say, well, not all liberals or not all conservatives, of course, see it this way, but I do, and this is how blah, blah, blah. But then when it comes to talking about those who disagree with them, they make really quick snap decisions and assumptions about, well, of course, all the conservatives are like this, or of course, all liberals think this way, and they kind of dismiss it and shut it down while being more willing to give, you know, more nuance and thought to those who they agree with. So it's just interesting watching them automatically do that without even realizing it.
It reminds me of the in the chapter there's the story about Robber's Cave, and it's kind of long, so I'm not going to recite it here, and I'll link to the You Are Not So Smart podcast where he basically reads the entire chapter, and it has the text there on his blog post for that podcast episode. But basically these young boys were taken to like a scout camp. And they didn't know, but they were segregated into two groups. They thought they were there by themselves. And then as soon as they found out there was another group there in the same campground area, they started competing. They made up names for each other, and they would spend a lot of time in the evenings talking about how stupid and dumb and awful the other group is, and talking about how great their own group was. So you had that it's one of those experiments that it's kind of good that they don't happen anymore, but it's kind of sad because it's so neat.
Indeed,
there's
yeah.
so much stuff that you can learn. This and the Stanford Prison Experiment,
and
you just can't do that stuff anymore.
Right, exactly.
You can't mess with people in the same way.
Stanley Milgram stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're lucky, I think. I think we learned from their unethical, or at least within our current view, they're unethical experiments. We're very insightful.
Indeed.
Thank you, IRB, right?
Exactly.
One thing that was both in the chapter and you can look up the actual New York Times article. There's a New York Times article called I'm Right for some reason. And it's a kind of a brief of this study that was addressing people's assumed in-depth knowledge over certain issues. So I'll just read a short little excerpt from this article. It says, in a forthcoming article in Psychological Science, written with Todd Rogers of the Harvard Kennedy School's Center for Public Leadership and Craig Fox of UCLA's Anderson School of Management, we report on experiments showing that people often believe they understand what is meant by well-worn political terms like the flat tax, sanctions on Iran, or cap and trade, even when they don't. That's not much of a shocker, of course. The real surprise is what happens after these same individuals are asked to explain how these policy ideas work. They become more moderate in their political views, either in support of such policies or against them. In fact, not only do their attitudes change, but so does their behavior. In one of our experiments, for example, after attempting to explain how various policy ideas would actually work, people became less likely to donate to organizations that supported the positions they had initially favored. Interestingly, asking people to justify their position, rather than asking them to explain the mechanisms by which the policy would work, doesn't tend to soften their political views. When we ask participants to state the reasons they were for or against a policy position, their initial attitudes held firm. Other researchers had found much the same thing. Merely discussing an issue often makes people more extreme, not less. I think that's really neat, and I think it shows the power of being willing to actually learn about another group, that you might actually humanize them a little bit. You might actually see that they have reasons for why they believe the things they believe or why they do the things that they do. So in The Righteous Mind, Jonathan Haidt's book, he talks about consuming conservative media, conservative news like Fox News and that sort of thing. And he began his career as an unabashed liberal atheist. And the more he listened to Fox News, not to find fodder to argue his position with, but as a social scientist trying to understand why they do the things that they do, it tempered his liberal fervor, it tempered his opinions a little bit, and he was able to see that there was some value to the conservative arguments. So I find that insight really powerful, that digging deep, not just kind of talking on the surface, but digging deep into something will usually help you appreciate it more, or at least temper you a little bit.
That is interesting, especially given how everything that we as a society have done for the last 5 or 6 decades has been to limit the amount of contact we have with people who disagree with us and engage with them in meaningful discussions and discourse about things. We've created news networks, right, that tell us the news that we like to hear. We've created social media sites where we can just interact with people who think just like we do. For the most part, in religion, people have picked churches where people just confirm the perspectives that they already have. They pick the political party, right, that just confirms what they already think. So yeah, we don't have many opportunities to do things like that. Or we don't take the opportunities.
Also, yeah, I think that also ties into where we are in our development, in our kind of our psychosocial development, in that there are theories out there that say, like, so there's a particular theory by Robert Keegan that has 6 stages of development. And his theory posits that only about 50% of the population of all people ever get past the fourth kind of level of development into those last two. And so we have a lot of kind of developmentally stunted adults walking around, where the main kind of identifying thing about that stage is that you cannot, it's hard to make the subject-object. It's difficult to objectify things. And so everything in your life is you. You feel ingrained in everything in your life. So you are relationship instead of you have relationships. Or you are a cougar or a ute instead of you go to BYU or you go to the University of Utah, for example, right? So everything is you. And so if that's the case, I think that if you're in these lower levels of identity development, then it's going to be more difficult to kind of be able to objectify these issues and these values in a way where you can really analyze them and dig deep to be, you know, objective as you look at something and not be so emotionally involved when you look at something. So I just think that piece is important when we're kind of talking about, I mean, this man in particular, I would say probably is quite a developed guy and has some kind of self-actualized tendencies to where he was able to do that. But I don't know that everyone, depending on where they are in their development, would have the ability to do that.
That's interesting, Michelle. It sounds like from what you're saying that the people at, what was it, the stage four that you're talking about,
right.
It sounds like what they're doing is conflating individual and group identities into one, that you are whatever your group is and vice versa, whereas the more developed, I guess, would be those who are able to distinguish between the individual and the group then and say, even though someone's a member of a particular group, doesn't necessarily mean that that defines who they are in every way.
Right, and even that the relationship, right, and even like your marriage relationship, to say it's something that I have, it's something that I participate in, but it's not the end all be all of my life.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it actually it gets a little at the end as we were kind of discussing this, and you know, in my BYU class, you know, the last stage of development, stage six, is one of the key kind of actions that happens in this stage is that people have extramarital affairs. And Robert Keegan sees it as a really normative thing for that stage of development is to have this extramarital affair. And in that reclaiming this, like, you know, or rejecting this idea of like that this marriage, this relationship is me. And if it goes away, it will be catastrophic because it's me and it means all these things about me. And so there was debate, obviously, in our class about if that was a good thing or a bad thing to have this affair. But I think that just this like radical idea of that you can literally give up all of these things and still be this actualized person because you can objectify things in your life and analyze them in a way that is you know logical and helps you make you know decisions that are informed as opposed to just based off of emotion. So, I like the guy that was able to do that. I just don't know if everyone would be able to. It's kind of a rant there, but
because that ties right into perceptions of threat and how that affects our perceptions of individual and group based relationships. So researchers who have looked at these group based relationships have also shown that how much we associate an individual with a group differs depending on the context. So, for example, when everything's happy and everything's good and you're not feeling threatened, there's no crisis, there's no conflict, it's easy to differentiate more between individual and groups. You know that people are members of groups, but you treat them more on an individual basis because, you know, everything's good, there's no threat. But when we feel threatened, when resources are scarce or when our core values are threatened, all of a sudden the group-based identities become much firmer and much more salient, and we begin interacting with individuals on the basis of their group identities, not on the basis of their individual identities. So it seems that during times of conflict, all of a sudden the group barriers become much more difficult to permeate and we solidify those opinions. Oh, everyone is like that member of the group. And going back to the issue with my students, like we see this very much during election season, right? Every 4 years when the presidential election comes up, all of a sudden it gets a lot harder to differentiate well the individuals who are planning on voting for the person that you're not planning to vote for, right? All of a sudden, they all look alike to you as the enemy. But then once the election's over, things go back down, all of a sudden they're like, okay, well, this person's not so bad, or I guess, yeah, I was friends with this person. We can be friends again until election season comes up once again and we start to interact on the basis of groups. So that's interesting. So tying that back into what you were saying, Misha, it sounds like level of development then and how much we associate individual with a group can often be contingent then upon the context and the amount of threat that we perceive. Would that be a fair way to think about that?
I think that's totally fair. And I think that that's a way of kind of kind of bridging these kind of two theories and making sense of them together and how they would kind of work with one another. And yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. And yeah, I think politics is a great example of when that occurs.
And that's interesting too, because it seems like that would tie in well with evolutionary theory, right? Like under times of threat, that's when the more rational parts of our brains start to shut down a little bit. We start operating more on instinct.
Right, that limbic system kicks in.
Yeah, exactly. Cool.
We see this illusion of asymmetric insight in the Mormon world, especially in the online Mormon world, all the time. And at first, it didn't make sense in the context of this resource thing. You know, we're not fighting for resource. There's plenty of internet for everybody. There's plenty of religion for everybody. But you also, Ben, talked about this becoming the groupishness popping up more when your core values are threatened, not just your resources. Mm-hmm. And I want to share two quotes, one from the You Are Now Less Dumb book, and then another one from a book that I'm reading right now by Catherine Schulz called Being Wrong. First, David McRaney, in talking about the Robber's Cave boys that made teams, he says, "You pick a team, like the boys at the Robber's Cave. You spend a lot of time talking about how dumb and uncouth the other side is. You, too, can become preoccupied with defining the essence of your enemy. You, too, need the other side to be inferior so that you define it as such. You start to believe that your persona, the thing that you embrace in certain groups, is actually your identity, and the identity of your enemy is actually his persona. You see yourself in a game of self-deluded poker and assume you are impossible to read while everyone else has obvious tells." So we start to, this kind of ties in our identity, right? And then in Being Wrong, she says that this whole thesis of this book is this feeling, is about making mistakes, and not only that, but recognizing what those mistakes are. She talks about the experience of recognizing that we've been wrong about something, we feel so embarrassed. And she says, "Recognizing our errors is such a strange experience. Accustomed to disagreeing with other people, we suddenly find ourselves at odds with ourselves. Error in that moment is less an intellectual than an existential one, a crisis, not in what we know, but who we are. We hear something of that identity crisis in the questions we ask ourselves in the aftermath of error. What was I thinking? How could I have done that?" So this, I think the way it ties into this Mormon world is that in the Mormon religion, it's not so much just about community or just about being a good person. It's stressed on both sides about getting the facts right and knowing the truth. The history is controversial, to say the least, and what is morally right for a church to do and how it should behave in public is something that's controversial as well. And so I think that's at the root. It's like this, our identity is tied in with the church, and we also have this need to be right all the time. When we're wrong, it's like this conflict within ourselves, and so we have to be right, and so it starts to be a competition for who can have the right answers, who can look at the data correctly, and who can come to the right conclusions.
Right, for sure, and we also, we're very highly motivated as humans to perceive our groups also as being right and being good, right? Because if we are a member of a group that's wrong, then that associates with our identities, because then that must mean we also are kind of wrong or bad in some way. So we have psychological motivations then to try to justify or rationalize why the groups we belong to are good or right in most circumstances.
I just think about all of the money that the church has poured into really reifying and solidifying this notion of Mormonism being identity, with the I Am a Mormon campaign and the I'm a Mormon, I know it, I live it, I love it slogan. And I just think, oh, it just it just is something that is really tough for me to sit with and to watch, because I know that I mean, that's already kind of the way that we do things, is to get this identity of being LDS and being Mormon and what that means. But as we've made this extra push, I just see that it has repercussions, because I see, you know, I see clients in therapy who, when a cog is kind of put into that wheel, you know, then your wrench is thrown into however it goes. Anyway, when something new information...
When someone throws a wrench in the works.
That's right.
Yeah.
When that starts to happen, this faith crisis or new information is introduced, it really messes with people's sense of identity. And it's like, okay, we have to rebuild almost from the ground up, because everything about this person's identity was tied into the church. And so that can be tough. And you know, I see that in therapy, and it's troubling for me. So.
And they're tied into what they understand the church to be, usually from the things that they were taught as a youth, which is generally pretty good stuff. You know, you need to be brave, you need to be kind, you need to serve others. Like those, there's not... My personal experience growing up LDS was not negative in any way. It was perfectly good. And so then when you learn about past leaders or even current leaders, you know, making decisions that are questionable, some of them questionable at best, it's like, whoa, hold on a second, because these people represent ourselves. You know, we're so tied in with everything Mormon that when we find a leader that's done something that we disagree with completely, it totally messes with who we are, and it breaks our identity down, and that's why we have this faith crisis. Also, I see it, I remember I read this Asymmetric Insight article, I don't know, 6 months ago, something like that, and you know, in the blogging world, you notice all these different things. You see, someone will share an ex-Mormon type article, and you can see how they're writing about others. And then you'll get an article from LDS Magazine or what is it called, Meridian Magazine, or one of those, and everyone pulls their hair out at the things that they're saying. And you see it very much. Like, from a believing perspective, you see people that have left the church or people in the middle. And the way they talk at General Conference, or the way I think it's even worse in like Meridian Magazine, is that they reduce someone who's having a faith crisis or someone who has left the church to someone who wants to sin or someone who just can't hack it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you can explain, or someone that just simply wasn't doing the fundamentals. They weren't praying, reading, going to the temple, those sort of things. Because it doesn't make sense that if they were doing all those things that I'm clearly doing, they would be fine and faithful just like me. And then on the other side, on those that are more critical of the church, often the other side is simplified, where these Mormons, all they do is listen to the prophet and they'll just obey without thinking at all. And, you know, there's nothing going on there except for whatever they're told to do, you know. And I think all the people that I grew up with, including myself, that there were a lot of things that we thought about and did that the prophet didn't tell us to do. You know, there's a lot of people, very, very smart people, that are LDS, and, you know, they're very complex people, and they make decisions that are sometimes against what the prevailing norms of the church are. And so it's frustrating to see these two poles minimize and simplify the other. But then when I read this article, I'm like, that's what we do. That's what humans are really good at doing. And then the people in the middle get it from both sides, like, you're not faithful enough, or then from the post or ex-Mormon side, you're inauthentic, you're just doing mental gymnastics or whatever, and the middle does it to the other way, like, you're too orthodox, or you didn't read enough, or something else. Like, there's so, every single group in this online world, you can see them oversimplify every other group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and we're much more, I think we do much better with kind of rigidity than flexibility. So, like, being dogmatic and really rigid, we're good at that. And then it's like something changes and then we flip to the other side in a radical way that's just as rigid and, you know, black and white thinking. And we're good at that. And neither on either side of it is healthy because it's going back to the same rigidity that causes problems. So if it's going to cause problems in one camp, it's going to cause problems in the other. And I don't think enough people examine that. And people who do examine that, right, again, kind of get the hate from both sides, which is unfortunate because they're the people that are giving themselves room for flexibility and complexity.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. It seems to me that perhaps then a strategy worth pursuing then is equipping people with the tools to help them be able to handle complexity and shades of gray and how they perceive the world. But it's got to be a rock. Like, I'm trying to put myself in the position of, like, church authorities in terms of how they structure curriculum, how they phrase things. And I think on one hand, there's a motivation and an incentive to be more black and white, right? Because they want people to be firm. They want people to have strong testimonies, and they want them to be loyal. And so they don't want them to be wishy-washy about it, right? But then at the other side of the spectrum is exactly what you just described, Misha, right? If you bring up a generation of people who are used to the world being black and white because that's all they're told, then as soon as they find any information that doesn't fit with that worldview, then the whole thing collapses. Whereas if they had been trained from an early age that things are more complex and that there's shades of gray between things, then perhaps they'd have been able to handle it. But then the risk with that is then that they might be wishy-washy too. So it's like either way you go, there's a pro and a con.
Absolutely. Well, and I just think about, so this is one of those stories that's like a secondhand thing. But I had a professor who said he was at a meeting or training with one of the apostles. I won't say the name because it's a secondhand story, but someone asked the apostle, what should I do about this? And the apostle said, I don't know. Like, you need to pray about it. He said, I'm a general authority. So I give general counsel. I don't give individual. I'm not an individual authority. So I don't give individual counsel. And I thought, yes, that is what needs to be being said over the pulpit at general conference, is that's what it means to be a general authority, that you give general counsel, and then it's up to folks to see how that applies or doesn't, or how you take it in your personal individual life. But that's not the way that we operate for the most part, which is unfortunate.
So. You know, that's a quote. It's probably, it might be from this story as well, but there's a Dallin H. Oaks article. It might have been a BYU address where he was talking about dating standards. Mm-hmm. And that's
that
where...
That seems familiar, yes.
He was saying, I'm not going to tell you the loopholes. That's something I tell you, I give you general advice or whatever the thing. I'm a general authority, so I give general instructions or something like that.
Right.
So I'll pull that up. That quote is often useful when you're trying to argue for a loophole. It's like, look, the authority told me I can have loopholes, and he's not going to tell me what they are.
What came to my mind, something that's kind of troubled me over the years, is not granting complexity to the members, not granting complexity to the leaders. And so, like, the prophet, we have a really hard time. Like, what I've seen from folks that I've interacted with is, like, it's super easy to call God racist over Brigham Young racist, which just baffles my mind, right? Like, that prophets can be fallible. We don't want to go there. And yet, we're totally fine with the prophets from the scriptures being fallible. You know, we're fine with Jonah being so disobedient that he had to be swallowed up by this giant fish to learn his lesson. But what we cannot get there with our modern day prophets. And I'm wondering if that is not about this Mormon identity, in that we don't conceptualize these prophets of old as Mormon. That's not the way that we, I think we would say, oh yeah, you know, I mean, that's the, you know, eventually their religion became Mormon, but we don't see them in that way. We see them as Jewish or Christian or the prophet of God, not Mormon, not LDS. And so because of that, we don't have to, we want to identify them in these, you know, our modern prophets now in these very specific ways that we have come up with as here's what Mormon is. Here's what a Mormon prophet is. A Mormon prophet is perfect. A Mormon prophet is infallible. A Mormon prophet is the mouthpiece of God. Whereas we don't really say those things about the other prophets because they're not Mormon. So I don't know. That just came to my mind is maybe that's part of that, but
yeah. And that,
yeah, I think the time, you know, they were ancient, they were from a different culture, mm-hmm. and all the Mormon prophets have been within, you know, the last 200 years or less, and things have certainly changed since the 19th century, mm-hmm. but it's not like going back 2,000 years in time or more, so there's like that comfortable distance where they can be a little weird, and they can teach weird things, and that's fine, but, you know, reading Brigham Young's biography is eye-opening. He's more like an Old Testament prophet, I think. Mm-hmm. Even reading, you know, the best one, I think, it's best because I just read it. David O. McKay's biography by Greg Prince. The first part I was in love with David O. McKay because it was about him not agreeing with the anti-evolutionists like Joseph Fielding Smith and stopping the printing, at least for a time, of Mormon doctrine and those sort of things. And there's this little story about him eating rum cake and people questioning, "President, you can't eat that. It has rum in it." And he says, "Well, the word of wisdom is about drinking, not eating." And so it's like this picture of this really loose but still very Mormon prophet. But then as you read further and further, there's so much more to his character, and there's like this wishy-washiness with different issues and this inability to come down and set the record straight at certain times. And so you do get this full picture of a prophet that lived, you know, 50 years ago. That's, you know, just a generation or two away, and you get this picture of what a Mormon prophet is, that they have a lot to deal with, and they have very human qualities.
I've got an experience I could share that illustrates myself falling victim to this exact phenomenon that we've been discussing in an LDS context. So, about a year and a half ago, we have a new stake presidency in our stake, and it's always interesting because going to various meetings and kind of hearing how they talk, and I'm trying to get a sense of, like, so what kind of Mormon are they like? Are they more black and white, iron rod types? Are they more nuanced, President Uchtdorf types? You know, I'm just trying to feel them out. And the sense that I had gotten from their talks and when they come visit and the things they prioritize are that they're much more iron rod types. Like, there was very little nuance in the way they were thinking. They were talking very, this is the way it is, this is how we have to be, this is what we need to do. Which admittedly then made me a little bit more cautious in terms of my interactions with them. That's probably great for most members in our stake, of course, but for more nuanced types like myself, that signaled to me, maybe they're not the ones I should be completely opening up with. So then just this last week came Temple Recommend renewal interview times, and our stake president was down, and I've been thinking about, like, all this, you know, ever since they got called in, so, like, so how do I approach this Temple Recommend interview in a way where I can, you know, be true to my authentic self, but at the same time recognize the group norms and the narratives of our community and translate kind of into the language that they're familiar with and such. So I went into the interview, and I felt pretty good answering questions, but I felt like, for the question when it's asked if we believe that the gospel has been restored, that to me is just a crazy question, just because of, like, all the different ways you can define gospel and restored and all this. So what I felt to say was that I believe rather that the gospel is being restored, but that it has not been completely restored yet. And I was not sure what he was going to say to that, but he kind of smiled and he said, "Oh, that's interesting. What do you mean by that?" I said, "Well, you know, President Uchtdorf said in conference a couple of years ago that the restoration is ongoing. It's not finished yet. There's still more truths to be revealed, and that the church isn't quite perfect yet, and there's ways that it can improve." And then I'm just kind of like, okay, so what's he going to say? And he just smiled and he said, yeah. He said, there's, you know, a lot of that that's been going on in the church lately. I think the recent essay from the church on the priesthood restoration is evidence that the church is continuing to improve and it's not perfect the way it was and that there's continual improvements being made. I was like, oh, that's very interesting. So I didn't expect him to show that much, you know, thoughtfulness in that answer. So we continued on and through, and then the... go ahead.
By the essay, did you mean the Race and the Priesthood essay?
That's the one, yes.
Okay, because I think you said the Restoration...
Oh, I'm sorry, essay. Race and the Priesthood essay. That's what I meant, yes. So then when we got to, what is it, the question about, you know, affiliating with groups whose teachings are blah, 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 the fun question there. And on that one, I pushed back just a little bit, and I said, well, as I understand the intent of the question, no, I don't. But a literal interpretation of this question is silly because everyone has friends or they vote for political parties or they work for organizations that teach things or that support things that are contrary to what the church teaches. And again, he kind of smiled at that and he said, well, that's true. I'm a member of the American Bar Association and they certainly support things that are contrary to the church sometimes. And then he said, and I had an interview with someone just a little while ago who had a family member who had an issue of same-sex attraction, and she told me that for her, if she had to choose between supporting her family member and supporting the church, that she would choose her family member, and that's what she felt was important. And he told me, and I told her that that was the right answer for her, if she felt like that's what, if she prayed about it and she felt good about that. And so he said, so he gave me his interpretation of the question, but that he was glad that the church allowed for the freedom that we have to individualize our interaction with the church. And anyways, so I'm going through all this and it's just blowing my mind. I thought, like, I had this image in my mind of him as a very authoritarian, black and white kind of a person based on the things that we'd heard from the pulpit. And then I come in here and he's showing all kinds of nuance and complexity and I thought, wow, I totally stereotyped him. Like, I just assumed because of the few things I'd heard him say that he was just like all those others, right? And so I was humbled by that, just to see that I was wrong in that instance, that he was a lot more nuanced than I had assumed.
Just like all those other simpletons.
Well, and as I'm kind of thinking about my reactions to your story, and I'm going, oh, wow. What an interesting guy. Great bishop. Awesome. And that is there's my, you know, bias coming out in that I was, you know, assuming the same thing about him. Mm-hmm. So just as you're telling the story and my shock and surprise tells you something about the way that I, you know, that I categorize and think about bishops. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems everyone's guilty of this, right? It's just something our brains do automatically without us even realizing that we do it.
Yeah, we're not self-actualized yet.
We're working on it. The first step is knowledge, right? At least we're aware that this is what we do so that we can...
Knowing is half the battle.
That's right. That's right. And that's what we're here for, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, are there any other thoughts or anything like that, or should we just kind of say we're done?
So what's the takeaway point? What's the challenge from this?
Okay, so...
It's our behavioral change. It's associated.
The way... This is frustrating because I have kind of a bleak outlook because I don't see a way of... Like, one of the things I would like to see is more... Less animosity between... critics and chapel Mormons and middle way Mormons, you know, more at least mutual respect, mutual understanding. And I don't see that happening because we don't have a common enemy. We have to have a common enemy. You know, one of those points from the thing about the resources is the only way that Earth will ever create a utopia is if Martians attack us. Because then we define the boundaries of the group around the entire globe and somewhere between us, between Earth and Mars. That's how we get a utopia, is getting into a war with Mars or some, you know, some aliens or something like that. That's the only way it'll work. So the question is, the closing question is there a way to unite different Mormons or just people in general without having a common enemy, or... is there a common enemy or a common goal? I guess it doesn't have to be an enemy, but at least a common goal that would unite different groups and therefore reduce the tension between them.
I thought it was the Great and Abominable Church, but maybe that was...
That one backfired.
I just think paying attention to when we are surprised by someone's words or actions. If we're surprised by the way that someone, something that someone says or the way that they act, I think it's important to sit back and analyze why were we surprised? Why did that, you know, go against what we had formally assumed? And I think that's a way of keeping ourselves in check, because I don't know that there's a way that we can all become, you know, perfect at this and get rid of it completely. But always checking in and saying, well, why am I surprised that this person did this? Is it because I'm not granting them the complexity I would want granted to me? Is it because of this type of stereotype that I assumed about them? So that would be, I don't know, that's my thought on it.
So like what you said, Brian, I mean, the cause of this is something that's part of the way that our brains are hardwired, that we've evolved over millennia to react this way. So it's not like we're just going to get rid of this in the course of a week, right? And it's just something that's going to be with us. So on one hand, yeah, I kind of share your pessimism in that. Are we able to transcend group identities and behavior? Probably not, no. So I think the best, or what we can, the ideal that we could strive for is at least being aware of how we react, then being able to self-monitor when we react that way and deliberately choose to act contrary to those inclinations that then we have, which is a hard thing to do because half the time we don't even realize that we do it. But nonetheless, I feel like that's something that the gospel calls us to, is to try, to the extent that we can, to transcend those group-based identities and see us all as, you know, fellow children of our heavenly parents.
You know, this is one of those moments where the wisdom found in the gospel relates directly to this psychological phenomenon, to human nature, which I think speaks to wisdom, right? Wisdom literature in general, like this idea of take the beam out of your own eye before you take the mote out of your neighbor's is calling you to look at yourself a little bit more before you jump to judgments about your neighbor. And I think, you know, the call to being patient is important, and not just patient with church leaders. You know, I have to be patient with other people too. When, you know, there are people early in a faith crisis or in some position where they're angry or something like that, and, you know, they're saying something that in my head I'm like, well, that's not quite factually correct. Maybe if I shared this bit of wisdom with them, they would understand. Maybe just letting them be might be the better choice than constantly correcting people, which, you know, sometimes I'm guilty of. So I think patience, you know, short of an alien attack on us, I think patience is probably our best bet.
No, you make a good point there. These reactions that we've been talking about, this asymmetric bias, is, on one hand, it's completely natural, right? But then the Book of Mormon teaches us that it's the natural man that's an enemy to God. You know, that's just because that happens. Just because it happens naturally doesn't necessarily mean that it's always therefore good. And, you know, we're called upon to try to overcome that to the extent that we can with the grace of God to help us.
I like it. Yeah, I think that's a good ending point. So that's the call, folks. Be patient, be self-reflective, and don't assume you know the totality of another person until you've had several long dinners with them.
There you go.
Well, thanks, Ben, and thanks, Misha, for being on the podcast. This is a lot of fun.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
Anytime.
Well, listeners, I hope you liked that, and I'm wondering if you can think of any other instances in your life, or in general, where you noticed this illusion of asymmetric insight, or perhaps maybe we missed an aspect of it. Either way, please share your thoughts in the podcast comments section. As for next week, it's a gamble depending on scheduling, so you can possibly Look forward to another part in the Top 10 Books in Mormon History series with Ben Park, discussing a book written by Kathleen Flake that covers the Reed Smoot trial in the early 20th century, or you may be in for another episode of Ask the Mormon Sex Therapist with Jennifer Finlayson Fife. With school semester starting up, many schedules are in the air, so either way, you have two great options to look forward to. And most importantly, until next time, keep keeping it weird.